"Aye, by my faith," said Athelstane, "and my duty as a subject besides, for here I tender him my allegiance, heart and hand."
"My son," said Edith, "think on thy royal rights."
"Think on the freedom of England, degenerate prince," said Cedric.
"Mother and friend," said Athelstane, "a truce to your upbraidings. Bread and water and a dungeon are marvellous mortifiers of ambition, and I arise from the tomb a wiser man than I descended into it. One half of those vain follies were puffed into mine ears by that perfidious Abbot Wolfram, and you may now judge if he is a counsellor to be trusted. Since these plots were set in agitation, I've had nothing but hurried journeys, indigestions, blows and bruises, imprisonment and starvation. Besides that they can only end in the murder of some thousands of quiet folks, I tell you, I will be king in my own domains and nowhere else, and my first act of dominion shall be to hang the abbot."
"And my ward, Rowena," said Cedric, "I trust you intend not to desert her."
"Father Cedric," said Athelstane, "be reasonable. The Lady Rowena cares not for me. She loves the little finger of my kinsman Wilfred's glove better than my whole person. There she stands to avouch it. Nay, blush not, kinswoman. There is no shame in loving a courtly knight better than a country franklin. And do not laugh, neither, Rowena, for grave clothes and a thin visage are, God knows, no matter of merriment. Nay, and thou wilt needs laugh, I will find thee a better jest. Give me thy hand, or rather lend it me, for I but ask it in the way of friendship. Here, cousin Wilfred of Ivanhoe, in thy favour I renounce and abjure."
"Hey, by St. Dunstan, our cousin Wilfred hath vanished! Yet, unless my eyes are still dazzled with the fasting I have undergone, I saw him stand there, but even now—"
All now looked around and inquired for Ivanhoe, but he had vanished. It was at length discovered that a Jew had inquired for him, and that, after very brief conference, he had called for Gurth and his armour, and had instantly left the castle.
"Fair cousin," said Athelstane to Rowena, "could I think that this sudden disappearance of Ivanhoe were occasioned by other than the weightiest reasons, I would myself resume—"
But he had no sooner let go her hand, on first observing that Ivanhoe had disappeared, than Rowena, who found her situation extremely embarrassing, had taken the opportunity to escape from the apartment.
"Certainly," quoth Athelstane, "women are the least to be trusted of all animals, monks and abbots excepted. I am an infidel if I expected not thanks from her, and perhaps a kiss to boot. These cursed grave clothes have surely a spell on them. Everyone flies from me. To you I turn, noble King Richard, with the vows of allegiance, which, as a liege subject—"
But King Richard was gone also, and no one knew whither. At length it was learned that he had hastened to the courtyard, summoned to his presence the Jew who had spoken with Ivanhoe, and, after a moment's speech with him, had called vehemently to horse, thrown himself on a steed, compelled the Jew to mount another, and set off at a rate which, according to Womba, rendered the old Jew's neck not worth a liard's purchase.
"By my halidome," said the astounded Athelstane, "it is certain Zernebock hath possessed himself of my castle in my absence. I return in my grave clothes, a pledge redeemed from the very sepulchre, and everyone I speak to vanishes so soon as they hear my voice. But it skills not talking of it. Come, my friends, such of you as are left, follow me to the banquet hall before any more of us disappear. It is, I trust, as yet tolerably furnished, as becomes the obsequies of an ancient Saxon noble, and should we tarry any longer, who knows but the devil may next fly off with his supper."
Chapter 13. Be Mowbray's sin so heavy in his bosom
that they may break his foaming courser's back and throw the rider headlong in the lists, a caitiff recreant.
Richard II. Our scene now returns to the exterior of the castle, or preceptory, of Templestowe, about the hour when the bloody die was to be cast for the life or death of Rebecca. It was a scene of bustle and life, as if the whole vicinage had poured forth its inhabitants to a village wake or rural feast. But the evident desire to look on blood and death is not peculiar to these dark ages, though in the gladiatorial exercises of single combat and general tourney, they were habituated to the bloody spectacle of brave men falling by each other's hands. Even in our own days, when morals are better understood, an execution, a bruising match between two professors, a riot, or a meeting of radical reformers, collects at considerable hazard to themselves immense crowds of spectators, otherwise little interested, excepting to see how matters are to be conducted, and whether the heroes of the day are, in the heroic language of insurgent tailors, flints or dunghills. The eyes, therefore, of a very considerable multitude were bent on the gate of the preceptory of Templestowe, with the purpose of witnessing the procession, while still greater numbers had already surrounded the tilt-yard belonging to that establishment. This enclosure was formed on a space of ground adjacent to the preceptory, which had been levelled with care for the exercise of military and chivalrous sports. It occupied the brow of a soft and gentle eminence, was carefully palisaded around, and as the Templars willingly invited spectators to be witnesses of their skill in feats of chivalry, was amply supplied with galleries and benches for the use of spectators. Upon the present occasion, a throne was erected at the eastern end for the Grand Master, surrounded with seats of distinction for the preceptors and knights of the order. Over these floated the sacred standard, called Le Beauséant, which was the ensign, as its name was the battle cry, of the Templars. At the opposite end of the lists was a pile of faggots, so arranged around a stake, deeply fixed in the ground, as to leave a space for the victim whom they were destined to consume, to enter within their fatal circle, in order to be chained to the stake by the fetters which hung ready for that purpose. Beside this deadly apparatus stood four black slaves, whose colour and African features, then so little known in England, appalled the multitude, who gazed on them as on demons employed about their own diabolical exercises. These men stirred not, excepting now and then, under the direction of one who seemed their chief, to shift and replace the ready fuel. They looked not on the multitude. In fact, they seemed insensible of their presence, and of everything save the discharge of their own horrible duty. And when, in speech with each other, they expanded their blabber lips and showed their white fangs, as if they grinned at the thoughts of the expected tragedy, the startled commons could scarcely help believing that they were actually the familiar spirits with whom the witch had convened, and who now, her time being out, stood ready to assist in her dreadful punishment. They whispered with each other, and enumerated all the feats which Satan had performed during that busy and unhappy period, not failing, of course, to give the devil rather more than his due.
"Have you not heard, Father Dennett,"
quoth one boor to another advanced in years,
"that the devil has carried away bodily the great Saxon thane, Athelstane of Coningsborough?"
"Ay, but he brought him back, though, by the blessing of God and St. Dunstan."
"How's that?"
said a brisk young fellow, dressed in a green cassock, embroidered with gold, and having at his heels a stout lad bearing a harp upon his back, which betrayed his vocation. The minstrel seemed of no vulgar rank, for besides the splendour of his newly broidered doublet, he wore around his neck a silver chain, by which hung the rest, or key, with which he tuned his harp. On his right arm was a silver plate, which instead of bearing, as usual, the cognizance or badge of the baron to whose family he belonged, had barely the word Sherwood engraved upon it.
"How mean you by that?"
said this gay minstrel, mingling in the conversation of the peasants.
"I came to seek one subject for my rhyme, and by a lady I were glad to find two."
"It is well avouched,"
said the elder peasant,
that after Athelstane of Coningsboro had been dead 4 weeks...
"'That is impossible,' said the minstrel. "'I saw him in life at the passage of arms at Ashby de la Zouche. "'Dead, however, he was, or else translated,' said the younger peasant, "'for I heard the monks of St. Edmund's singing the death hymn for him. "'And moreover, there was a rich death meal and dole at the castle of Coningsboro, "'as right was, and thither had I gone, but for Mabel Parkins, who—'
"'Aye, dead was Athelstane,'
said the old man, shaking his head.
"'And the more pity it was, for the old Saxon blood—'
"'But your story, my masters, your story,' said the minstrel somewhat impatiently.
"'Aye, aye, construe us the story,'
said a burly friar, who stood beside them, leaning on a pole that hovered in appearance betwixt a pilgrim's staff and a quarter-staff, and probably acted as either when occasion served.
"'Your story,' said the stalwart churchman, "'burn not daylight about it. We have short time to spare.'
"'And please, your reverence,' said Dennett, "'a drunken priest came to visit the sacristan at St. Edmund's.
"'It does not please my reverence,' answered the churchman, "'that there should be such an animal as a drunken priest, "'or, if there were, that a layman should so speak him. "'Be mannerly, my friend.' "'And concludes the holy man only wrapped in meditation, "'which makes the head dizzy and foot unsteady, "'as if the stomach was filled with new wine. "'I have felt it myself.'
"'Well, then,' answered Father Dennett, "'a holy brother came to visit the sacristan at St. Edmund's. "'A sort of a hedge priest is the visitor, "'and kills half the deer that is stolen in the forest.' Who loves the tinkling of a pint pot better than the sacring bell, and deems a flitch of bacon worth 10 of his breviary. For the rest, a good fella and a merry, who will flourish a quarterstaff, draw a bow, and dance a Cheshire round with e'er a man in Yorkshire.
That last part of thy speech, Dennett, said the minstrel, has saved thee a river twain.
Shush, man, I fear him not, said Dennett. I am somewhat old and stiff, but when I fought for the bell and ram at Doncaster—
But the story, my friend, again said the minstrel.
Why, the tale is but this. Athelstane of Coningsboro was buried at St. Edmund's.
That's a lie, and a loud one, said the friar, for I saw him borne to his own castle of Coningsboro.
Nay, then, e'en tell the story yourself, my masters,
said Dennett, turning sulky at these repeated contradictions, and it was with some difficulty that the boor could be prevailed, by the request of his comrade and the minstrel, to renew his tale.
"'These two sober friars,' said he at length, "'since this reverend man will needs have them such, "'had continued drinking good ale and wine and what not "'for the best part of a summer's day, when they were aroused,' by a deep groan and a clanking of chains, and the figure of the deceased Athelstane entered the apartment, saying, "'Ye evil shepherds!' "'It is false,' said the friar hastily. "'He never spoke a word.'
"'So-ho, Friar Tuck,' said the minstrel, drawing him apart from the rustics, "'we have started a new hare, I find.'
"'I tell thee, Allan a Dale,' said the hermit, I saw Athelstane of Coningsboro as much as bodily eyes ever saw a living man. He had his shroud on, and all about him smelt of the sepulchre. A butt of sack will not wash it out of my memory.
Pshaw, answered the minstrel, thou dost but jest with me.
Never believe me, said the friar, and I fetched not a knock at him with my quarterstaff that would have felled an ox, and had glided through his body as it might through a pillar of smoke.
"'By St. Hubert,' said the minstrel, "'it is a wondrous tale, "'and well fit to be put in metre to the ancient tune "'Sorrow Came to the Old Friar.'
"'Laugh, if ye list,' said Friar Tuck. "'But an ye catch me singing on such a theme, "'may the next ghost or devil carry me off with him headlong. "'No, no, I instantly formed the purpose of assisting at some good work, "'such as the burning of a witch.' A judicial combat, or the like matter of godly service.
As they thus conversed, the heavy toll of the church of St. Michael of Templestowe, a venerable building situated in a hamlet at some distance from the preceptory, broke short their argument.
One by one the sullen sounds fell successively on the ear, leaving but sufficient space for each to die away in distant echo, ere the air was again filled by repetition of the iron knell. These sounds, the signal of the approaching ceremony, chilled with awe the hearts of the assembled multitude, whose eyes were now turned to the preceptory, expecting the approach of the Grand Master, the champion, and the criminal. At length the drawbridge fell, the gates opened, and a knight, bearing the great standard of the order, sallied from the castle, preceded by six trumpets, and followed by the knight's preceptors, two and two, the Grand Master coming last, mounted on a stately horse, whose furniture was of the simplest kind. Behind him came Brian de Bois-Guilbert, armed cap-a-pie in bright armour, but without his lance, shield, and helmet, which were borne by his two esquires behind him. His face, though in part hidden by a long plume which flowed down from his basnet cap, bore a strange and mingled expression of passion, in which pride seemed to contend with irresolution. He looked ghastly pale, as if he had not slept for several nights, yet reined his pawing war-horse with the habitual ease and grace proper to the best lance of the Order of the Temple. His general appearance was grand and commanding, but on looking at him with attention, men read that in his dark features, from which we willingly withdraw our eyes. On either side rode Conrad of Mount Fitchett and Albert de Malvoisin, who acted as godfathers to the champion. They were in their robes of peace, the white dress of the order. Behind them followed other knights companions of the temple, with a long train of esquires and pages, clad in black, aspirants to the honour of being one day knights of the order. After these neophytes came a guard of warders on foot, in the same sable livery, amidst whose partisans might be seen the pale form of the accused, moving forward with a slow but undismayed step towards the scene of her fate. She was stripped of all her ornaments, lest perchance there should have been among them one of those amulets which Satan was supposed to bestow upon his victims to deprive them of the power of confessing, even when under the torture. A coarse white dress, of the simplest form, had been substituted for her oriental garments, yet there was such an exquisite mixture of courage and resignation in her looks that even in this garb, and with no other ornament than her long black tresses, each eye wept that looked upon her, and even the most hardened bigot regretted the fate that had converted a creature so goodly into a vessel of wrath and a waged slave of the devil. A crowd of inferior personages belonging to the preceptory followed the victim, all moving with the utmost order, with arms folded and looks bent upon the ground. This slow procession moved up the gentle eminence, on the summit of which was the tilt-yard, and, entering the lists, marched once around them from right to left, and when they had completed the circle, made a halt. There was then a momentary bustle, while the Grand Master and all his attendants, excepting the champion and his godfathers, dismounted from their horses, which were immediately removed out of the lists by the esquires, who were in attendance for that purpose. The unfortunate Rebecca was conducted to the black chair placed near the pile. On her first glance at the terrible spot where preparations were making for her dying a death, alike dismaying to the mind and painful to the body, she was observed to shudder and shut her eyes, praying internally, doubtless, for her lips moved, though no speech was heard. In the space of a minute she opened her eyes, looked fixedly on the pile, as if to familiarize her mind with the object, and then slowly and naturally turned away her eyes. Meanwhile, the Grand Master had assumed his seat, and when the chivalry of his order was placed around and behind him, each in his due rank, a loud and long flourish of the trumpets announced that the court were seated for judgment. Malvoisin, then, acting as the godfather of the champion, stepped forward and laid the glove of the Jewess, which was the pledge of battle, at the feet of the Grand Master.
"Valorous lord and reverend father," said he, "here standeth the good knight Brian de Bois-Guilbert, knight preceptor of the Order of the Temple, who, by accepting the gage of battle, which I now lay at your reverence's feet,
hath become bound to do his devoir in combat this day, to maintain that this Jewish maiden, by name Rebecca, hath justly deserved the doom passed upon her in a chapter of the most holy order of the Temple of Zion, condemning her to die as a sorceress. And here, I say, he standeth such battle to do, knightly and honourably, if such be your noble and sanctified pleasure.
Hath he made oath, said the Grand Master, that his quarrel is just and honourable? Bring forward the crucifix and the Te Igitur.
Sir and most reverend father, answered Malvoisin readily, our brother here present hath already sworn to the truth of his accusation in the hand of the good knight Conrad de Montfichet, and otherwise ought he not to be sworn, seeing that his adverse party is an unbeliever and may take no oath. This explanation was satisfactory to Albert's great joy, for the wily knight had foreseen the great difficulty, or rather impossibility, of prevailing upon Brian de Bois-Guilbert to take such an oath before the assembly, and had invented this excuse to escape the necessity of his doing so. The Grand Master, having allowed of the apology of Albert de Malvoisin, commanded the herald to stand forth and do his devoir. The trumpets then again flourished, and a herald, stepping forward, proclaimed aloud,
Oyez! 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 Here standeth the good knight, Sir Brian de Bois-Guilbert, ready to battle with any knight of free blood who will sustain the quarrel allowed and allotted to the Jewess Rebecca, to try by champion, in respect of lawful essoin of her own body. And to such champion, the reverend valour of the Grand Master here present allows a fair field, true and equal partition of sun and wind, and whatever else appertains to a fair combat.
The trumpets again sounded, and there was a dead pause of many minutes.
No champion appears for the appellant, said the Grand Master. Go, herald, and ask her whether she expects anyone to do battle for her in this her cause.
The herald went to the chair in which Rebecca was seated, and Bois-Guilbert, suddenly turning his horse's head towards that end of the lists, in spite of the hints on either side from Malvoisin and Montfichet, was by the side of Rebecca's chair as soon as the herald.
"Is this regular, and according to the laws of combat?"
said Malvoisin, looking to the Grand Master.
"Albert de Malvoisin, it is," answered Beaumanoir.
"For in this appeal to the judgment of God, we may not prohibit parties from having that communication with each other which may best tend to bring forth the truth of the quarrel." In the meanwhile, the herald spoke to Rebecca in these terms. "Damsel, the honourable and reverend Grand Master demands of thee, if thou art prepared with a champion to do battle this day in thy behalf, or if thou dost yield thee as one justly condemned to a deserved doom?"
"Say to the Grand Master," replied Rebecca, "that I maintain my innocence, and will not yield me as justly condemned, lest I become guilty of mine own blood. Say to him that I challenge such delay as his forms will permit, to see if God, whose opportunity is in man's extremity, will raise me up a deliverer, and when such uttermost space is past, may his holy will be done."
The herald retired to carry this answer to the Grand Master.
"God forbid," said Lucas de Beaumanoir, "that Jew or pagan should impeach us of injustice.
Until the shadows be cast from the west to the eastward, will we wait to see if a champion will appear for this unfortunate woman. When the hour of noon is so far past, let her prepare for death." The herald communicated the words of the Grand Master to Rebecca, who bowed her head submissively, folded her arms, and, looking up towards heaven, seemed to expect that aid from above which she could scarce promise herself from man. During this awful pause, the voice of Bois-Guilbert broke on her ear. It was but a whisper, yet it startled her more than the summons of the herald had appeared to do.
"Rebecca,"
said the Templar.
Dost thou hear me?
I have no portion in thee, cruel, hard-hearted man, said the unfortunate maiden.
Aye, but dost thou understand my words? Said the Templar. For the sound of my voice is frightful in mine own ears. I scarce know on what ground we stand, or for what purpose they have brought us hither. This listed space, that chair, these faggots, I know their purpose. And yet it seems to me something unreal, the fearful picturing of a vision which appalls my sense with hideous fantasies, which convince not my mind. My mind and senses keep touch and time, answered Rebecca, and tell me alike that these faggots are destined to consume my earthly body and open a painful but a brief passage to a better world.
Dreams, Rebecca, dreams, answered the Templar. Idle visions, rejected by the wisdom of your own wiser Sadducees. Hear me, Rebecca, he said, proceeding with animation. A better chance hast thou for life and liberty than yonder knaves and dotard dream of. Mount thee behind me on my steed, on Zamor, the gallant horse that never failed his rider. I won him in single fight from the Soldan of Trebizond. Mount, I say, behind me. In one short hour is pursuit and inquiry far behind. A new world of pleasure opens to thee, to me a new career of fame. Let them speak the doom which I despise, and erase the name of Bois Guilbert from their list of monastic slaves. I will wash out with blood whatever blot they may dare to cast on my scutcheon.
Tempter, said Rebecca, be gone.
Not in this last extremity canst thou move me one hair's breadth from my resting place. Surrounded as I am by foes, I hold thee as my worst and most deadly.
Avoid thee, in the name of God.
Albert de Malvoisin, alarmed and impatient at the duration of their conference, now advanced to interrupt it.
Hath the maiden acknowledged her guilt? He demanded of Bois Guilbert. Or is she resolute in her denial?
She is indeed resolute, said Bois Guilbert.
Then, said Malvoisin, must thou, noble brother, resume thy place to attend the issue. The shades are changing on the circle of the dial. Come, brave Bois Guilbert, come, thou hope of our holy order, and soon to be its head.
As he spoke in this soothing tone, he laid his hand on the knight's bridle, as if to lead him back to his station.
False villain! What meanest thou by thy hand on my rein? Said Sir Brian angrily,
and shaking off his companion's grasp, he rode back to the upper end of the lists.
There is yet spirit in him, said Malvoisin, apart to Mount Fitchett, were it well directed. But, like the Greek fire, it burns whatever approaches it.
The judges had now been 2 hours in the lists, awaiting in vain the appearance of a champion. It became the general opinion that no one would wage battle for the unhappy maiden.
And reason good, said Friar Tuck, seeing she is a Jewess. And yet, by mine order, it is hard that so young and beautiful a creature should perish without one blow being struck in her behalf. Were she 10 times a witch, providing she were but the least bit of a Christian, my quarterstaff should ring noon on the steel cap of yonder fierce Templar ere he carried the matter off thus.
It was, however, the general belief that no one could or would appear for a Jewess accused of sorcery, and the knights, instigated by Malvoisin, whispered to each other that it was time to declare the pledge of Rebecca forfeited. At this instant, a knight, urging his horse to speed, appeared on the plain, advancing towards the lists. 100 voices exclaimed,
A champion! A champion!
And, despite the prepossession and prejudices of the multitude, they shouted unanimously as the knight rode into the tilt-yard. The second glance, however, served to destroy the hope that his timely arrival had excited. His horse, urged for many miles to its utmost speed, appeared to reel from fatigue, and the rider, however undauntedly he presented himself in the lists, either from weakness, weariness, or both, seemed scarce able to support himself in the saddle. To the summons of the herald, who demanded his rank, his name, and purpose, the stranger knight answered readily and boldly, "I am a good knight and noble, come hither to sustain with lance and sword the just and lawful quarrel of this damsel, Rebecca, daughter of Isaac of York, to uphold the doom pronounced against her to be false and truthless, and to defy Sir Brian de Bois-Guilbert as a traitor, a murderer, and a liar, as I will prove in this field with my body against his, by the aid of God, of Our Lady, and of Monseigneur St. George, the good knight." "The stranger must first show," said Malvoisin, "that he is good knight and of honourable lineage. The temple sendeth not forth her champions against nameless men." "My name," said the knight, raising his helmet, "is better known, my lineage more pure, Malvoisin, than thine own. I am Wilfred of Ivanhoe."
"I will not fight with thee," said the Templar, in a changed and hollow voice. "Get thy wounds healed. Purvey thee with a fresh horse, and it may be I will hold it worth my while to scourge out of thee this boyish spirit of bravade."
"Ha! Proud Templar," said Ivanhoe, "hast thou forgotten that twice didst thou fall before this lance? Remember the lists at Arca. Remember the passage of arms at Ashby. Remember thy proud vaunt in the halls of Rotherwood, and the gage of your gold chain against my reliquary, that thou wouldst do battle with Wilfred of Ivanhoe, and recover the honour thou hast lost. By that reliquary, and the holy relic it contains, I will proclaim thee, Templar, a coward in every court of Europe, and every preceptory of thine order, unless thou do battle without farther delay." Bois-Guilbert turned his countenance irresolutely towards Rebecca, and then exclaimed, looking fiercely at Ivanhoe,
"Dog of a Saxon sire, take thy lance, and prepare for the death thou hast drawn upon thee."
"Does the Grand Master allow me the combat?" said Ivanhoe.
"I may not deny what you have challenged," said the Grand Master, "providing the maiden accepts thee as her champion. Yet I would thou wert in better plight to do battle. An enemy of our order hast thou ever been, yet would I have thee honourably met with."
Thus as I am, and not otherwise," said Ivanhoe. "It is the judgment of God. To his keeping I commit myself." "Rebecca," said he, riding up to the fatal chair, "dost thou accept of me for thy champion?"
"I do," she said. "I do," fluttered by an emotion which the fear of death had been unable to produce. "I do accept thee as the champion whom heaven hath sent me. Yet no, thy wounds are uncured. Meet not that proud man. Why shouldst thou perish also?" But Ivanhoe was already at his post, and had closed his visor and assumed his lance. Bois-Guilbert did the same, and his esquire remarked that as he clasped his visor, his face, which had, notwithstanding the variety of emotions by which he had been agitated, continued during the whole morning of an ashy paleness, now became suddenly very much flushed. The herald then, seeing each champion in his place, uplifted his voice, repeating thrice, "Faites-vous devoir, preux chevalier!" After the third cry, he withdrew to one side of the lists, and again proclaimed that none, on peril of instant death, should dare by word, cry, or action to interfere with or disturb this fair field of combat. The Grand Master, who held in his hand the gauge of battle, Rebecca's glove, now threw it into the lists, and pronounced the fatal signal words,
"Laissez aller!"
The trumpets sounded, and the knights charged each other in full career. The wearied horse of Ivanhoe, and its no less exhausted rider, went down, as all had expected, before the well-aimed lance and vigorous steed of the Templar. This issue of the combat all had expected, but although the spear of Ivanhoe did but, in comparison, touch the shield of Bois-Guilbert, that champion, to the astonishment of all who beheld it, reeled in his saddle, lost his stirrups, and fell in the lists. Ivanhoe, extricating himself from his fallen horse, was soon on foot, trusting to mend his fortune with his sword, but his antagonist arose not. Wilfred, placing his foot on his breast and the sword point to his throat, commanded him to yield him or die on the spot. Bois-Guilbert returned no answer.
"Slay him not, Sir Knight," cried the Grand Master. "Unshriven and unabsolved, kill not body and soul. We allow him vanquished."
He descended into the lists and commanded them to unhelm the conquered champion. His eyes were closed. The dark red flush was still on his brow. As they looked on him in astonishment, the eyes opened, but they were fixed and glazed. The flush passed from his brow and gave way to the pallid hue of death. Unscathed by the lance of his enemy, he had died a victim to the violence of his own contending passions.
"This is, indeed, the judgment of God," said the Grand Master, looking upwards. "Fiat voluntas tua."
Chapter 14. So now 'tis ended, like an old wife's story. Webster. When the first moments of surprise were over, Wilfred of Ivanhoe demanded of the Grand Master, as judge of the field, if he had manfully and rightfully done his duty in the combat.
"Manfully and rightfully has it been done," said the Grand Master. "I pronounce the maiden free and guiltless. The arms and the body of the deceased knight are at the will of the victor."
"I will not despoil him of his weapons," said the Knight of Ivanhoe, "nor condemn his corpse to shame. He hath fought for Christendom. God's arm, no human hand, hath this day struck him down. But let his obsequies be private, as becomes those of a man who died in an unjust quarrel. And for the maiden..." He was interrupted by a clattering of horses' feet, advancing in such numbers and so rapidly as to shake the ground before them, and the Black Knight galloped into the lists. He was followed by a numerous band of men-at-arms and several knights in complete armour.
"I am too late," he said, looking around him. "I had doomed Bois Guilbert for mine own property. Ivanhoe, was this well, to take on thee such a venture, and thou scarce able to keep thy saddle?"
"Heaven, my liege," answered Ivanhoe, "hath taken this proud man for its victim. He was not to be so honoured in dying as your will had designed."
"Peace be with him," said Richard, looking steadfastly on the corpse, "if it may be so. He was a gallant knight, and has died in his steel harness full knightly. But we must waste no time. Bowen, do thine office."
A knight stepped forwards from the king's attendants, and, laying his hand on the shoulder of Albert de Malvoisin, said,
"I arrest thee of high treason."
The Grand Master had hitherto stood astonished at the apparition of so many warriors. He now spoke.
"Who dares to arrest a knight of the Temple of Zion, within the girth of his own preceptory, and in the presence of the Grand Master? And by whose authority is this bold outrage offered?"
"I make the arrest," replied the knight. "I, Henry Bowen, Earl of Essex, Lord High Constable of England."
"And he arrests Malvoisin," said the king, raising his visor, "by the order of Richard Plantagenet, here present. Conrad Mountfitchet, it is well for thee thou art born no subject of mine. But for thee, Malvoisin, thou diest with thy brother Philip, ere the world be a week older."
"I will resist thy doom," said the Grand Master.
"Proud Templar," said the king, "thou canst not. Look up and behold, the royal standard of England floats over thy towers instead of thy temple banner. Be wise, Beaumanoir, and make no bootless opposition. Thy hand is in the lion's mouth."
"I will appeal to Rome against thee," said the Grand Master,
"for usurpation on the immunities and privileges of our order."
"Be it so," said the king, "but for thine own sake, tax me not with usurpation now. Dissolve thy chapter, and depart with thy followers to thy next preceptory, if thou canst find one, which has not been made the scene of treasonable conspiracy against the King of England, or if thou wilt remain to share our hospitality and to behold our justice."
"To be a guest in the house where I should command?" said the Templar. "Never. Chaplains, raise the psalm, Quare fremuerunt gentes, knights, squires, and followers of the Holy Temple.
prepare to follow the banner of Beauséant."
The Grand Master spoke with a dignity which confronted even that of England's king himself and inspired courage into his surprised and dismayed followers. They gathered around him like the sheep around the watchdog when they hear the baying of the wolf. But they evinced not the timidity of the scared flock, though a dark brows of defiance and looks which menaced the hostility they dared not to proffer in words. They drew together in a dark line of spears, from which the white cloaks of the knights were visible among the dusky garments of their retainers, like the lighter-coloured edges of a sable cloud. The multitude, who had raised a clamorous shout of reprobation, paused and gazed in silence on the formidable and experienced body to which they had unwarily bade defiance, and shrunk back from their front. The Earl of Essex, when he beheld them pause in their assembled force, dashed the rowels into his charger's sides and galloped backwards and forwards to array his followers in opposition to a band so formidable. Richard alone, as if he loved the danger his presence had provoked, rode slowly along the front of the Templars, calling aloud, "What, sirs, among so many gallant knights, will none dare splinter a spear with Richard? Sirs of the Temple, your ladies are but sunburned, if they are not worth the shiver of a broken lance." "The brethren of the Temple," said the Grand Master, riding forward in advance of their body, "fight not on such idle and profane quarrel, and not with thee, Richard of England, shall a Templar cross lance in my presence. The Pope and princes of Europe shall judge our quarrel, and whether a Christian prince has done well in bucklering the cause which thou hast today adopted. If, unassailed, we depart, assailing no one. To thine honour we refer the armour and household goods of the order which we leave behind us, and on thy conscience we lay the scandal and offence thou hast this day given to Christendom." With these words, and without waiting a reply, the Grand Master gave the signal of departure. Their trumpets sounded a wild march of an oriental character, which formed the usual signal for the Templars to advance. They changed their array from a line to a column of march, and moved off as slowly as their horses could step, as if to show it was only the will of their Grand Master, and no fear of the opposing force, which compelled them to withdraw. "By the splendour of Our Lady's brow," said King Richard, "it is pity of their lives that these Templars are not so trusty as they are disciplined and valiant." The multitude, like a timid cur which waits to bark till the object of its challenge has turned his back, raised a feeble shout as the rear of the squadron left the ground. During the tumult which attended the retreat of the Templars, Rebecca saw and heard nothing. She was locked in the arms of her aged father, giddy and almost senseless, with the rapid change of circumstances around her. But one word from Isaac at length recalled her scattered feelings.
"Let us go," he said, "my dear daughter, my recovered treasure, let us go to throw ourselves at the feet of the good youth."
"Not so," said Rebecca. "Oh, no, 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 I must not at this moment dare to speak to him. Alas, I should say more than no, my father. Let us instantly leave this evil place."
"But my daughter," said Isaac,
"to leave him who hath come forth like a strong man with spear and shield, holding his life as nothing, so he might redeem thy captivity, and thou too, the daughter of a people strange unto him and his, this is service to be thankfully acknowledged."
It is most thankfully, most devoutly acknowledged. It shall be still more so. But not now. For the sake of thy beloved Rachel, father, grant my request, not now."
"Nay, but," said Isaac, insisting, "they will deem us more thankless than mere dogs.
But thou seest, my dear father, that King Richard is in presence, and that true, my best, my wisest Rebecca. Let us hence, let us hence. Money he will lack, for he has just returned from Palestine, and, as they say, from prison. And pretext for exacting it, should he need any, may arise out of my simple traffic with his brother John. Away, away, let us hence."
and hurrying his daughter in his turn, he conducted her from the lists, and, by the means of conveyance which she had provided, transported her safely to the house of the Rabbi Nathan. The Jewess, whose fortunes had formed the principal interest of the day, had not retired so much unobserved, but for the attention of the populace having been transferred to the Black Knight. They now filled the air with, "Long life to Richard with a lion's heart, and down with the usurping Templars!" "Notwithstanding all this lip loyalty," said Ivanhoe to the Earl of Essex, "it was well the king took the precaution to bring thee with him, noble earl, and so many of thy trusty followers." The earl smiled and shook his head. "Gallant Ivanhoe, dost thou know our master so well, and yet suspect him of taking so wise a precaution? I was drawing towards York, having heard a rumour that Prince John was making a head there, when I met King Richard, like a true knight-errant, galloping hither to achieve this adventure of the Templar and the Jewess with his own single arm. I accompanied him with my band, almost maugre his consent."
"And what news from York, brave Earl?" said Ivanhoe. "Will the rebels bide us there?"
"No more than December's snow will bide July's sun," said the Earl. "They are dispersed, and who should come posting to bring the news but John himself?"
"The traitor! The ungrateful, insolent traitor!" said Ivanhoe.
"Did not Richard order him into confinement?"
"Oh, he received him," replied the Earl, "as if they had met after a hunting party, and, pointing to me and our men-at-arms, said, 'Thou seest, brother, I have some angry men with me. Thou wert best go to our mother, carry her my duteous affection, and abide with her until men's minds are pacified.'"
"And this was all he said?" replied Ivanhoe.
"Would not anyone say that this prince invites to treason by his clemency?"
"Just," replied the Earl, "as the man may be said to invite death who undertakes to fight a combat with a dangerous wound unhealed."
"I forgive thee the jest, Lord Earl," said Ivanhoe, "but remember, I hazarded but my own life, Richard, the welfare of his kingdom."
"Those," replied Essex, "who are specially careless of their own welfare are seldom remarkably attentive to that of others. But let us haste to the castle, for Richard meditates punishing some of the subordinate members of the conspiracy, though he has pardoned their principal."
From the judicial investigations which followed on this occasion, and which are given at length in the Wardour manuscript, it appears that Maurice de Bracy escaped overseas and went into the service of Philip of France, while Philip de Malvoisin and his brother Albert, the preceptor of Templestowe, were executed, although Waldemar Fitzurse, the soul of the conspiracy, escaped with banishment, and Prince John, for whose behoof it was undertaken, was not even censured by his good-natured brother. No one, however, pitied the fate of the two Malvoisins, who only suffered the death which they had both well deserved by many acts of falsehood, cruelty, and oppression. Briefly after the judicial combat, Cedric the Saxon was summoned to the court of Richard, which, for the purpose of quieting the counties that had been disturbed by the ambition of his brother, was then held at York. Cedric tushed and pshawed more than once at the message, but he refused it not. In fact, the return of Richard had quenched every hope he had entertained of restoring a Saxon dynasty in England, for whatever head the Saxons might have raised in the event of a civil war, it was plain that nothing could be done under the undisputed dominion of Richard, popular as he was by his personal good qualities and military fame, although his administration was wilfully careless, now too indulgent, and now allied to despotism. But, moreover, it could not escape even Cedric's reluctant observation that his project for an absolute union among the Saxons, by the marriage of Rowena and Athelstane, was now completely at an end by the mutual dissent of both the parties concerned. This was, indeed, an event which, in his ardour for the Saxon cause, he could not have anticipated, and even when the disinclination of both was broadly and plainly manifested, he could scarce bring himself to believe that two Saxons of royal descent should scruple on personal grounds at an alliance so necessary for the public weal of the nation. But it was no less certain
Rowena had always expressed her repugnance to Athelstane, and now Athelstane was no less plain and positive in proclaiming his resolution never to pursue his addresses to the Lady Rowena. Even the natural obstinacy of Cedric sunk beneath these obstacles, where he, remaining on the point of junction, had the task of dragging a reluctant pair up to it, one with each hand. He made, however, a last vigorous attack on Athelstane, and he found that resuscitated sprout of Saxon royalty engaged, like country squires of our own day, in a furious war with the clergy. It seems that, after all his deadly menaces against the abbot of St. Edmund's, Athelstane's spirit of revenge, what betwixt the natural indolent kindness of his own disposition, what with the prayers of his mother Edith, attached, like most ladies of the period, to the clerical order, had terminated in his keeping the abbot and his monks in the dungeons of Coningsborough for 3 days on a meagre diet. For this atrocity the abbot menaced him with excommunication and made out a dreadful list of complaints in the bowels and stomach suffered by himself and his monks in consequence of the tyrannical and unjust imprisonment they had sustained. With this controversy, and with the means he had adopted to counteract this clerical persecution, Cedric found the mind of his friend Athelstane so fully occupied that it had no room for another idea. And when Rowena's name was mentioned, the noble Athelstane prayed leave to quaff a full goblet to her health, and that she might soon be the bride of his kinsman Wilfred. It was a desperate case, therefore. There was obviously no more to be made of Athelstane, or, as Womba expressed it, in a phrase which has descended from Saxon times to ours, he was a cock which would not fight. There remained betwixt Cedric and the determination to which the lovers desired he should come to only two obstacles, his own obstinacy and his dislike of the Norman dynasty. The former feeling gradually gave way before the endearments of his ward, and the pride which he could not help nourishing in the fame of his son. Besides, he was not insensible to the honour of allying his own line to that of Alfred, when the superior claims of the descendant of Edward the Confessor were abandoned forever. Cedric's aversion to the Norman race of kings was also much undermined, first by consideration of the impossibility of ridding England of the new dynasty, a feeling which goes far to create loyalty in the subject, and secondly by the personal attentions of King Richard, who delighted in the blunt humour of Cedric, and, to use the language of the Wardour manuscript, so dealt with the noble Saxon that, ere he had been a guest at court for 7 days, he had given his consent to the marriage of his ward Rowena and his son Wilfred of Ivanhoe. The nuptials of our hero, thus finally approved by his father, were celebrated in the most august of temples, the noble Minster of York. The king himself attended, and from the countenance which he afforded on this and other occasions to the distressed and hitherto degraded Saxons, gave them a safer and more certain prospect of attaining their just rights than they could have rationally hoped from the precarious chance of civil war. The church gave her full solemnities, graced with all the splendour which she of Rome knows how to apply with such brilliant effect. Girth, gallantly apparelled, attended as esquire upon the young master whom he had served so faithfully, and the magnanimous Womba, decorated with a new cap and a most gorgeous set of silver bells. Sharers of Wilfred's dangers and adversity, they remained, as they had a right to expect, the partakers of his more prosperous career. But besides this domestic attendance, these distinguished nuptials were celebrated by the attendance of the high-born Normans as well as Saxons, joined with the universal jubilee of the lower orders that marked the marriage of two individuals as a type of the future peace and harmony betwixt two races, which since that period have been so completely mingled that the distinction has become utterly invisible. Cedric lived to see this union approximate towards its completion, for as the two nations mixed in society and formed intermarriages with each other, the Normans abated their scorn, and the Saxons were refined from their rusticity. But it was not until the reign of Edward III that the mixed language, now termed English, was spoken at the court of London, and that the hostile distinction of Norman and Saxon seems entirely to have disappeared. It was upon the second morning, after this happy bridal, that the Lady Rowena was made acquainted by her handmaid Elgitha that a damsel desired admission to her presence, and solicited that their parley might be without witness. Rowena wondered, hesitated, became curious, and ended by commanding the damsel to be admitted and her attendants to withdraw. She entered, a noble and commanding figure, the long white veil in which she was shrouded, overshadowing rather than concealing the elegance and majesty of her shape. Her demeanour was that of respect, unmingled by the least shade either of fear or of a wish to propitiate favour. Rowena, however full of her own rank, was ever ready to acknowledge the claims and attend to the feelings of others. She arose, and would have conducted the lovely stranger to a seat, but she looked at Elgitha, and again intimated a wish to discourse with the Lady Rowena alone. Elgitha had no sooner retired, with unwilling steps, than, to the surprise of the Lady of Ivanhoe, her fair visitant kneeled on one knee, pressed her hands to her forehead, and, bending her head to the ground, in spite of Rowena's resistance, kissed the embroidered hem of her tunic. "What means this?" said the surprised bride. "Or why do you offer to me a deference so unusual?"
"Because to you, Lady of Ivanhoe," said Rebecca, rising up and resuming the usual quiet dignity of her manner, "I may lawfully and without rebuke pay the debt of gratitude which I owe to Wilfred of Ivanhoe. I am, forgive the boldness which has offered to you the homage of my country, I am the unhappy Jewess, for whom your husband hazarded his life against such fearful odds in the tilt-yard at Templestowe."
"Damsel," said Rowena, "Wilfred of Ivanhoe on that day rendered back, but in slight measure, your unceasing charity towards him in his wounds and misfortunes. Speak, is there aught remains in which he and I can serve thee?"
"Nothing," said Rebecca calmly, "unless you will transmit to him my grateful farewell."
"You leave England, then," said Rowena, scarce recovering the surprise of this extraordinary visit.
"I leave it, lady, ere this moon again changes. My father hath a brother high in favour with Mohammed Boabdil, King of Granada. Thither we go, secure of peace and protection, for the payment of such ransom as the Muslim exact from our people."
"And are you not then as well protected in England?" said Rowena.
"My husband has favour with the king. The king himself is just and generous."
"Lady," said Rebecca, "I doubt it not. But the people of England are a fierce race, quarrelling ever with their neighbours or among themselves, and ready to plunge the sword into the bowels of each other. Such is no safe abode for the children of my people. Ephraim is an heartless dove, Issachar an over-laboured drudge, which stoops between two burthens. Not in a land of war and blood, surrounded by hostile neighbours and distracted by internal factions, can Israel hope to rest during her wanderings."
"But you, maiden," said Rowena, "you surely can have nothing to fear. She who nursed the sickbed of Ivanhoe," she continued, rising with enthusiasm, "she can have nothing to fear in England, where Saxon and Norman will contend who shall most do her honour."
"Thy speech is fair, lady," said Rebecca, "and thy purpose fairer, but it may not be. There is a gulf betwixt us. Our breeding, our faith alike forbid either to pass over it. Farewell, yet ere I go, indulge me one request. The bridal veil hangs over thy face. Raise it, and let me see the features of which fame speaks so highly."
"They are scarce worthy of being looked upon," said Rowena, "but expecting the same from my visitant, I remove the veil." She took it off accordingly, and partly from the consciousness of beauty, partly from bashfulness, she blushed so intensely that cheek, brow, neck, and bosom were suffused with crimson. Rebecca blushed also,
but it was a momentary feeling, and, mastered by higher emotions, passed slowly from her features, like the crimson cloud which changes colour when the sun sinks beneath the horizon. "Lady," she said, "the countenance you have deigned to show me will long dwell in my remembrance. There reigns in it gentleness and goodness, and if a tinge of the world's pride or vanities may mix with an expression so lovely, how may we chide that which is of earth for bearing some colour of its original? Long, long will I remember your features, and bless God that I leave my noble deliverer united with—" She stopped short, her eyes filled with tears. She hastily wiped them, and answered to the anxious inquiries of Rowena, "I am well, lady, well. But my heart swells when I think of Torquilstone and the lists at Templestowe. Farewell. One, the most trifling part of my duty, remains undischarged. Accept this casket. Startle not at its contents." Rowena opened the small silver-chased casket and perceived a carcanet or necklace with ear-jewels of diamonds which were visibly of immense value. "It is impossible," she said, tendering back the casket. "I dare not accept a gift of such consequence." "Yet keep it, lady," returned Rebecca. "You have power, rank, command, and influence. We have wealth, the source alike of our strength and weakness. The value of these toys, 10 times multiplied, would not influence half so much as your slightest wish. To you, therefore, the gift is of little value, and to me what I part with is of much less. Let me not think you deem so wretchedly ill of my nation as your commons believe. Think ye that I prize these sparkling fragments of stone above my liberty, or that my father values them in comparison to the honour of his only child? Accept them, lady. To me they are valueless. I will never wear jewels more." "You are then unhappy," said Rowena, struck with the manner in which Rebecca uttered the last words. "Oh, remain with us. The council of holy men will wean you from your unhappy lore, and I will be a sister to you." "No, lady," answered Rebecca, the same calm melancholy reigning in her soft voice and beautiful features. "That may not be. I may not change the faith of my fathers like a garment unsuited to the climate in which I seek to dwell, and unhappy, lady, I will not be. He to whom I dedicate my future life will be my comforter, if I do his will." "Have you then convents, to one of which you mean to retire?" asked Rowena. "No, lady," said the Jewess, "but among our people, since the time of Abraham downward, have been women who have devoted their thoughts to heaven and their actions to works of kindness to men, tending the sick, feeding the hungry, and relieving the distressed. Among these will Rebecca be numbered. Say this to thy lord, should he inquire after the fate of her whose life he saved." There was an involuntary tremor in Rebecca's voice, and a tenderness of accent, which perhaps betrayed more than she would willingly have expressed. She hastened to bid Rowena adieu. "Farewell," she said. "May he who made both Jew and Christian shower down on you his choicest blessings. The bark that wafts us hence will be under way ere we can reach the port." She glided from the apartment, leaving Rowena surprised as if a vision had passed before her. The fair Saxon related the singular conference to her husband, on whose mind it made a deep impression. He lived long and happily with Rowena, for they were attached to each other by the bonds of early affection, and they loved each other the more from recollection of the obstacles which had impeded their union. Yet it would be inquiring too curiously to ask whether the recollection of Rebecca's beauty and magnanimity did not recur to his mind more frequently than the fair descendant of Alfred might altogether have approved. Ivanhoe distinguished himself in the service of Richard, and was graced with father marks of the royal favour. He might have risen still higher, but for the premature death of the heroic Coeur de Lion before the castle of Chaluz, near Limoges.
with the life of that generous but rash and romantic monarch, perished all the projects which his ambition and his generosity had formed, and to him may be applied, with a slight alteration, the lines composed by Jonson for Charles of Sweden. His fate was destined to a foreign strand, a petty fortress and a humble hand. He left the name at which the world grew.